Even men at the top of their game find themselves wanting more from life. Whether it's more meaning, unshakable confidence, a bigger impact, more money, deeper love, a hotter sex life, or a powerful legacy. Find out how good your life can be on this episode of Man Alive. Also, did you know there's a skill many men never learn that ends up seriously limiting your professional success and satisfaction in your love and sex life? I put together a free guide to explain this unknown skill and give you exactly what you need to use it today. Get it by heading over to shaynajamescoaching.com or text the word ALIVE, A-L-I-V-E, to 44144. That's 44144. You'll also get access to Man Alive outtakes, raw footage, and bonus videos you can only get there. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Man Alive. I feel really touched and moved to have our guest here today, Terry Patton. Terry, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm really happy to have you. And I can feel this, just a deep place in my heart that you touch and that you're touching with this new work of yours. So Terry just wrote a book called A New Republic of the Heart, An Ethos for Revolutionaries. And for those of you who don't know Terry, he is a philosopher, an author, an activist, a consultant, a social entrepreneur, a coach. He co-wrote the book Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber, Adam Leonard, and Marco Morelli, which I read in grad school about, I'm dating myself, probably 15, 20 years ago, which had a really profound impact on my life as well back then. And you know, I would say as a teacher and a coach, he's introduced thousands of people to integral practice. He's taught online courses in integral spiritual practice, living the integral heart. You've done so much, you know, as a community organizer, as a social entrepreneur. I could go on and on and on. So I think really what I want to start with is a deep thank you from my heart for doing the work you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's nice to hear that.
Yeah. And your book, you know, I know you wrote that the book represents an attempt to complete this, you know, enormous unfinished work of your generation, a legacy for your sons and your daughters and a catalyst because we're in a pretty intense time with some big questions around, you know, what is really happening? Where are we headed? Is human civilization coming apart? Are we going to come together in a way we never have before? Or are we going to fall apart? You know, there really are there's no known path, right?
Exactly so. And the fact is we're all facing questions that nobody has full and complete answers to. And we don't tend to admit that, you know?
Yes. And on top of all the personal things, you know, I think about the men listening, right? On top of all the personal and parental and business and whatever, everything that's happening, there's also this larger political climate, you know, environmental climate. So, I mean, maybe we even start with how do you handle all of this, right? Like how do you manage to focus on all of this at the same time in such a deep and heartfelt way?
Well, you know, quite honestly, it just drives me crazy when I'm kind of like one of those people who doesn't like small talk.
Yeah.
If there's an elephant in the room, I'd like to talk about it. And I not just to talk about it, but to face it and deal with it. And it has gradually become clearer and clearer to me over the course of my life that human civilization is facing some just critical problems that easily could lead to the breakdown of many systems and, well, in the case of our ecological emergency, you know, just pretty horrific events. Just the wildfires we had near here last year, the record flood in the history of the country in Houston, also the same year, what happened in Puerto Rico. You know, the climate science seems to indicate that we're going to have more and more and more of that. Well, at a certain point, can the insurance industry continue to insure these losses? Probably not. When does it create mass migrations that are even worse than the ones that have already disrupted Europe? et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot in the pipes that seems pretty daunting.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we're in a time of miracles too, with exponential advances in technology and amazing things going on at the level of inner work and relationships and consciousness and awakening. So it's like big positive things and big scary things are looming on all sides, and it's a really non-linear dynamic. And it felt to me important to have real conversations with others, because I would continually begin to have such conversations and discover that we're all deeply emotionally committed to denial. We just don't
deeply emotionally committed to denial. That's a powerful way to say that.
Yeah. Because we're afraid that if we really turn and face the terrible truth, it's going to just totally depress us and enervate us and leave us hopeless. And so we don't want to think about it.
Right.
But we make it worse, really, because if you actually take a look at your at that which scares you, take away its power. And so I spent quite a bit of time delving pretty deeply into the science and the facts around our situation, but also all the creative good work that people are doing to make a difference and try to understand the scale of all that. And then bring into focus the ways that the area that's been most meaningful to me in my life, I've been a spiritual practitioner and a student of psychology and spirituality and a teacher for most of my adult life. And I have a very rich and multidimensional awareness of that whole landscape in a way that could integrate the different kinds of truths that are held by different kinds of work, such that I saw that in order to deal with our problems, we have to become a different kind of human being. We have to actually get to another place in ourselves. We have to evolve. We have to be, you know, it's like basically human civilization has always run into problems that have caused it to have a new wave of innovation. And, you know, whether you look at it negatively, like the problems did it, or you look at it positively, like the discovery of the new world or the discovery of fossil fuels, you know, there were a variety of things that created a burst of growth.
Yeah.
Maybe there were problems environmentally that caused us to begin cultivating food and generate the birth of agriculture. Maybe it was a problem. Maybe it was a breakthrough.
Yeah.
Everything is both, right? There were problems.
Well, that's actually a really powerful way to see it, right? That paradox that everything actually is both versus, you know, putting it in one category or another.
Well, you know, that's a core of integral thinking, is graduating from either or to both and thinking. And getting that right now, there's a dead end, unfortunately, ahead for many of the ways and the patterns in which people are living. And it may actually turn out to be the most invigorating, exciting, meaningful, and genuinely joyful period of our lives, even though
we could be on the brink of disaster, right? It's like
and actually experiencing some disasters.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's amazing how joyful people can become after their home has been burned down and they've lost all their belongings.
Right.
We have each other. Yeah. And they just remember what matters, you know.
I was just listening. It's so funny. My son, who is 6, we were just talking about our sons, and yours is, you know, 29 and more of an adult. But I was just listening to some podcasts with my son the other day, and there was one about this couple who was so grateful for each other. Let's do a quick summary, right? And then they got 3 wishes, and they started feeling greedy, and then ultimately in the end realized, like, oh, you know, when the potential for riches and wealth and all of that is introduced, we started fighting and got greedy. But when it wasn't there, we were just so grateful for each other, right? It seems like that's what you're pointing to. It's like we can get back to these basics. But I want to not skip over something you said before, which is that we as humans need to evolve. And I would love your perspective, your wisdom of, well, how do we need to evolve? What are we evolving into that could actually, I don't know if save us is the right word, but, you know, get us through this?
Well, you know, when I first began exploring the world of practice, the goal was enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And then I began to see it as an integral matter. And so there were all kinds of other words like peak performance and optimizing our capacities. And but a lot of that was focused on the individual. Like, I will turn myself into a, you know, machine of excellence on every level. I'll discipline my use of time and my attention and my physical and, you know, diet exercise practices, and I'll become, you know, the very best version of myself. Mm-hmm. But then I began to realize, although I spent many years being a pretty intense practitioner and teaching practice in all those ways, that we're also dealing with the biggest problems that we all have are problems that we all have. Like, the biggest problem in my life, probably, in a way, is the ecological predicament of the human species.
Right.
And how do I relate to that in a meaningful way? Mm-hmm. And what I keep finding is that people become so disheartened in the face of those things that we don't bring our best to them. You know, things really are. I have a line I use often: things are far too serious for us to lose our sense of humor. And yeah, it really says something essential, that the serious dark stuff point us to me, the quickest way out is through. We have to go into all the things we're afraid of and discover a more meaningful life on the other side of them. That's really the opportunity, and that's the way a practitioner deals with things. Mm-hmm. We don't avoid and suppress and fake. You know, it's about being authentic, and it's about being authentically present to everything and the things that we feel most deeply.
Yeah.
So this matter of evolving to another stage, well, partly it's necessitated.
Yeah.
All of human civilization is going to have to make a major stage transition to keep going. And it may be that there'll be some big disasters along the way. There probably will be some enormous disasters, and maybe millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions or billions of people might die in some of those disasters. And that would be shocking and all the rest. But we're going to have to come together on the other side of that, doing something a little differently.
Yes.
And we're already beginning to do a lot of things differently, and those things might avert the worst of those disasters.
Mm-hmm.
So really what we can usefully do is sort of the same thing in either case. It's either I'm going to be the thing that would turn it all around if it can be turned around, or I'm going to go down trying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be doing that before there's a disaster, and maybe I'll avert it, or I'll do it after there's a disaster and there'll be new windows of opportunity.
Right.
You know, that's the thing. There's a bit of a silver lining, even if there's a horrible disaster, is that it opens up an opportunity for more fundamental redesign of the systems that we live in.
And you wrote about this kind of, you said, you know, you could either call it spiritual activism or activist spirituality, right? That fuses this inner work and personal transformation with the outer work of service and activism and social entrepreneurship. And it seems like, right, this evolution has to include both the inner and the outer, and kind of infusing each with the other.
Yeah. You know, I was raised in a place called the York Center Community Co-op. It was just 20 miles west of Chicago. My parents moved there when I was six. And it was quite an amazing intentional community. It had been founded by members of the Church of the Brethren, one of the peace churches in the United States. And they invited people of other races and religions to live together with them in this little 70-family wow. community as a witness for peace and brotherhood. So I had all these African-American and mixed marriage and Japanese-American and Jewish and mixed Jewish-Christian and this and that, you know, parents' friends and friends' parents who were socially, you know, committed activists, many of them, kind of mentoring me as I grew up in the Vietnam War years. And as a kid, I was kind of raised to be a revolutionary. And then I realized that even though I was a, you know, reasonably good person, I wasn't a criminal, but I needed to become different. The revolution, if there was going to be a revolution that I was going to participate in bringing about, I had to transform my own being first. So I became focused on the inner work. I found my way to the Human Potential Movement. I got involved in an ashram where I spent the first half of my adult life. And I really did encounter, I was lucky, you know, I found a great teacher and I really did get the benefits of that, of the really, the intersection, the rare thing that's happened in my lifetime of all the world's spiritual traditions coming into conversation with each other in a way they never had before. And so I've really benefited from that. But then I've seen also that folks who are focused on that inner work often don't realize that, you know, there's a nobility of saying, you know, if I'm pointing at a problem out there in the world or with another person, three of my fingers are pointing back at me. So I should do my own work first. And they're taking that to heart. So they feel kind of morally superior in a way. And they're also saying, you know, the problems in the world just can't be solved with the kind of consciousness that created them. So I'm going to change my consciousness. Well, yes, however, right? You know, you're right about that. But I think you're signing an IOU when you do that. You know, you got to cycle back around and say, okay, now with whatever change I've been able to bring to my consciousness, what about those problems? What about really dealing with them?
Right.
And I think that that's the strength of the activists, that they really get that we're in a life situation that requires us to participate in co-creating anything better. Like there's nobody who's going to change this world for us.
Right.
If it's going to change, we're going to find our way into being that change in a genuine way. And it isn't like Bill Gates is going to do it for you or Elon Musk. It's not like Jordan Peterson's going to do it for you. It's not like the president right now, you know, is the last person to look to.
For us.
But even, you know, secretaries general or the most creative, dynamic people in the world can't do the whole thing. It's gonna, if there's going to be that kind of change, eventually it's going to have to generate from the seat that you're sitting in. You know, it's every one of us is implicated. And there's got to be a way of taking that to heart without just putting the weight of the world on your shoulders. You've got to find your way to discover that as something exciting and joyful and empowering, and it's, you know, and that inspiration can bring a whole lot of new energy into your life. And that's what I think that the careful reader of my book will emerge with. I think that so many of us realize that in a way we have this deep feeling of dread because it does not look good if you add up columns A, B, C, D, and E, and while you're reading the news.
Right. It doesn't look good. But I love this line that you wrote, you know, it will ultimately require revolutionary changes in human consciousness, behavior, culture, the physical, economic, political infrastructure of our whole civilization, and that it's vast and intricate, that it easily seems impossible, and we might be tempted to despair. But the despair easily becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly.
Yeah, very well said.
It's a funny deal. We have one of the things that we've understood now with recent psychological research is that no matter what direction you go in, you end up with all your good and bad motives getting mixed up and being part of that process. So if you're hopeful, you're partly hopeful for good, healthy reasons, but you're probably also in denial and you're not wanting to face things and so forth. That's part of what goes into your hope. And if you're feeling depressed, part of it is the courage to face the terrible truth, but then you also begin to become a participant in this self-fulfilling prophecy that draws you to depression and draws the world to the exact directions that you're afraid of. Mm-hmm. So all of that is a part of the picture. And if we can understand that, we can begin to be a little more self-compassionate and get that our own motives will never be entirely pure. And yet,
and that's okay.
It's okay. And yet when you see yourself being involved in some kind of avoidance and being full of it in one way or another, it's good to face that and learn those lessons and outgrow it. I think the process of growth, you always become a hypocrite because you begin to aspire to something you can't really embody. Mm-hmm. So that there's the gap, you know, between your talk and your walk or your aspiration.
As soon as you reach what you're trying to embody, you can see the next thing that you couldn't see before.
Exactly. So you're always out over your skis a little bit. Right. And that's okay. You know, that's really okay. We've got to become self and other compassionate about those kinds of factors, because we're in a moment where if we don't all grow, really grow in big ways that we never have before, we're toast. And we're going to have to come together and cooperate and have conversations.
Yeah.
At such a deep level.
Do you have a sense of that? Like when you talk about these conversations that need to happen, I mean, in some ways it seems obvious, but in other ways, you know, I'm just curious how you would phrase that, or how you would talk about initiating those conversations, or what conversations we could be, if we bring this to a personal level, right? What are the conversations that we need to be involved in to actually forward positive change for the world, for our children and grandchildren? And how do we do that?
Well, I identify a lot of specific conversations that I think are important in the book. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about all that. I don't want to give you an avalanche of information. One thing I'll say is that what passes for conversation is very often a kind of dueling. It's like a contest for dominance,
right?
And yeah. It's not really like. The kind of conversation I'm interested in is one in which we actually discover real new truths.
Oh, I like that. Right.
And in which we actually make contact with each other, where our relationship is deepened and furthered. And that kind of conversation is a shared inquiry. It's where we both admit to ourselves that we are interested in questions for which nobody has final answers, or even adequate answers, if we really are honest about the big questions in our world right now. Mm. And if we face that, and then we lean in, okay, well, we need better answers to these questions. Well, that creates a space for us to have an amazing, process of discovery. And then when somebody says something, you go, oh, wow, let me take that in. And you feel something new and you say something you never would have thought of, and they take it in and something new comes out of that. And then that sparks something for you and you connect it to something else, and actual new insight enters they call it the noosphere. It's that actual new understanding can come into the world.
Right, which is that kind of conversation that creates some kind of evolution, versus, like you said, it's just a dueling for dominance, or just recycling old material that's not actually taking us somewhere new.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that adversarial discourse is incapable of advancing understanding. I think that you know, some of our favorite public intellectuals, I think of Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, actually, the mm-hmm. kind of people of the moment, as examples, that they battle it out. And in the process, they articulate their ideas better and other people are educated and they serve a social function. I respect them. I've benefited from listening to both of those guys. Yeah. And yet then all the innovating has been done by them offline. You know, but when they get onto the public conversation circuit, they're not having a conversation with somebody interested to hear ideas that will reshape their thought and then to develop their thought into new directions. They're interested to more clearly articulate their point of view so that they can recruit more people to see things the way they do. Uh-huh. And I don't think that that's the most interesting and powerful kind of conversation. And it's not the thing that's going to evolve culture. I don't think that it's without value. I just don't think it's the only way to talk. And yet we have a whole culture that defaults to that again and again and again. I mean, those are the good conversations. What we get on like cable TV talk shows and so forth is a joke by comparison.
Yeah. You also wrote about a no matter what commitment. And I'm curious if you could talk about that, because again, I feel like it brings it down to this personal level. And you wrote that under the worst case scenario, right, can we still tap into this well of uncaused and unreasonable happiness? Can we still relate to our fellow humans and to all of life with care and love? And can we still, to the fullest extent possible, remain present as a force for good in every moment? And you know, that a no matter what commitment resolves the dilemmas. So I'm curious if you can talk about that some more.
Yeah. Well, what I discovered is, as I got into this topic of what's really happening on the planet and what can I do to be part of that, which would, see, I think we're facing an existential crisis on a collective level that is so profound mm-hmm. that it is, it's mind-blowing. You know, nobody's ever had to deal with the mortality of, you know, big chunks of the living Earth as the consequence. That's why, and it's gotten into everybody's psyche. I mean, you go to the multiplex and half the movies are all about saving the world or destroying the world. And we all sense that you know, we're in a real jam.
Yes.
So, I discovered that what was going on was that once I stopped looking away from it, once I put my eyeballs in a vise and forced myself to really look at the bad news about the environment and global warming and nitrogen and phosphorus
and all that. Carbon dioxide, right?
Just the whole deal.
Yeah.
Once I really looked at that, then I discovered that I was kind of, like in the stages of grief, there's the bargaining. And I was kind of thinking, well, maybe if we do this and we do that, we can avert this. Like there's this book by Paul Hawken that puts together this drawdown project and identifies all the things that if we did them all, we implemented them all right now, within 30 years, we could start drawing down the carbon in the atmosphere and we could be living this amazingly clean, you know, cultural, it would be great for the environment and there'd be all kinds of things that bring us together. So it seems like a solution, but you know, nobody's implementing that. What's going on right now is we're rolling back regulations and,
right,
you know, drilling for even more fossil fuels and so forth. The political will is what's missing. It's at the human level that we're blowing it. And mm-hmm. and so what I realized was that I had to find my way beyond the, are we going to make it? Are we not going to make it? And it was as if I didn't really want to be committed to being engaged unless I saw a strategy through which we could pull it off. And then if I thought I could win the game, I'd play the game. You know, like somebody who's
interesting,
you know, who's not willing to invest in a game they can't win. There's some part of me that didn't want to be as fully emotionally committed to the future of my whole
of existence. Yeah. Of your family and existence.
Right.
Well, it's humbling, right? I mean, it's kind of like you were talking about, and I was thinking about spiritual practice and facing our fears and to commit to something that you actually aren't sure if you can accomplish or win. I mean, that takes a whole lot of humility.
Yes, exactly so. And yet, what I discovered that I, and it's the substance of a lot of the work that I'm doing now that the book has been published, is I'm convening conversations that are really of a different kind, where that humility, that broke, you know, it's disarming, and it's my God, it's hard enough to face your own death, or it's hard enough to face the death of your dog, you know, it's hard enough to face the death of your parents.
Yeah.
To face even death of an individual, but to imagine that we could bring the whole
thing down,
the whole of the current pattern of human civilization would involve, well, billions ultimately of deaths. Mm-hmm. But you know, something would probably survive. But would we have a kind of dystopian Mad Max Waterworld kind of, you know, future, or would we? What would come of it? Like that stuff is so profoundly disturbing that most Yes. people's brains are shutting down, and we're just not getting into it. Mm-hmm. And I want to have the real conversation, because there's actually a heroic impulse in everybody's heart. Mm. And it does give us the basis for a no matter what commitment. Like you can get to a place where you realize, well, heck, I'm going to make my life an expression of everything that's healthy and that expresses wholeness and consciousness and love and freedom and truth, and I'm going to be a force for the wholesome health of life and the future of life
no matter what,
and I'm going to do that no matter what. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to do that no matter what. Now I'll either go down. The great Jungian psychologist James Hillman wrote a book at the end of his life called The Force of Character, in which he kind of was reflecting, gosh, I'm in my 80s, I've already done all my work, what's my life about now? And he said, you know, gosh, I guess I've already created my life's work, which is my character, and now I'm putting the finish on it. The finish of my life. But it's also like using the fine grit paper and putting on the oil and buffing it to a high sheen and really putting a finish on it. And I think that if the whole of human, you know, this chapter of human civilization, or even the end of the human species, were to happen, it would really matter how we did it. Right. So that I would want to be an example of resourcefulness and love and waking up and getting down to it and being part of the health of the whole thing, even if it was going to come to an end. And that right. would be what would turn it around. So that's a no matter what commitment. It's like, I'm down for being the thing that could have turned it around if it could have been turned around. That's right. A no matter what commitment.
Which I imagine, right? You know, okay, if it does go down, if we go down, we're down. And, you know, we won't know of anything else. But if it doesn't go down, it's like, right, there's that integrity within us that we tried and we gave it our all and we can respect ourselves. You know, and I'm wondering kind of...
And there's real happiness in that.
Right. Yes.
It's not yes. just some booby prize.
Right. It's not just, okay, I worked hard and that's, you know, now no. I can find myself. It's like there's actually joy and actually connection and in that.
One of my friends, the futurist Peter Russell, came to the conclusion that for a variety of reasons, not actually just about global warming, really about the inherently self-accelerating nature of our lives at this time, he decided that he thought that there really was no hope that the human race was going to go extinct. He thought mm-hmm. that was just inevitable. But where it took him, and this was so moving to me, was to just, oh, I see all these people that I've been so mad at that I think are screwing everything up. They're confused, but nobody, he found himself just forgiving everything. and everyone, and wow. seeing how the karmas are inherent and how the seeds of all the confusion go back forever. And he just found himself softening and softening and softening. And we he and I were talking about this idea from the Kabbalistic teaching about writing your name in the book of life. And it's kind of like how you live your life, who you are, how you love, how you give your energy, how you keep your word, how, you know, those kind of virtues are how you write your name in the book of life. And and he found himself saying, you know, we have at least a generation or two, you know, and we can fulfill the potentials of what it is to be human. And so he's just become soft and sweet. Wow. He meditates a lot, and he's just interested in that quality of awakening. And I resonate with that. I actually don't agree with his analysis. I think it's really, really important that everybody realize that no, you know, as Yogi Berra said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. Mm-hmm. And so nobody knows. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And the fact that we don't know means that it's really important that we feel a sense of possibility.
Yeah. And I think we could talk about this forever, and I highly recommend you listening, you know, read this book. I'm partway through it. I haven't finished it because it's really thick and incredible, but A New Republic of the Heart, it's called again. And I think, Terry, that part of what you're bringing in this legacy of yours and this catalyst of yours is this hope and is this possibility and is this reminder that we don't know and we can't know. And so, all right, you know, how are we going to step up in the face of that? And that stepping up, like you said, it's not just this dirty work or, you know, intense work or hard work, I guess I should say more than dirty work, that there's actually joy and there's actually, you know, depth and connection and inspiration in the stepping up into this. So I'm curious for now, you know, what do you want to leave people with who are listening? What's most important to you? I mean, in some ways it feels like a silly question because I think we're so deep in the territory that all of this is what's most important to you, but what do you want to end with?
Well, there are a lot of possible takeaways. One might be that it's so, so important that we neither give way to cynicism nor to going numb and going to sleep. When people were exploring in the Arctic, the potential of dying and giving in was paradoxical, because you'd be feeling so cold and you'd be just struggling and struggling, and then as you began to actually freeze to death, you'd start feeling warm. Huh. And the thing you couldn't let yourself do is give in to this comforting feeling of warmth and going to sleep. Don't go to sleep. Don't go to sleep. And I think that's a good analogy for something right now. Like, there's a discomfort in confronting everything in our right. world. It's a crazy, 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 crazy moment. Mm-hmm. And it seems too much, and it is kind of in a way. But if we don't give in to cynicism and numbness, there's something in this discomfort that is the catalyst for us to be living lives of amazing joy, amazing meaning, and being the change that's needed and actually make a difference. And we can. I'm committed to that. And that's, that's my parting shot.
Yeah, don't go to sleep, you know, and I can feel my own temptation. I can feel my own overwhelm. And so, again, I'm grateful for you for being this reminder, you know, and calling us out and calling us into a deeper way, a truer way, and a way that does take courage. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for writing this, and, you know, for the decades of work that have gone into this as well.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to hang out with you, and I'm glad we're reconnecting. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so glad you joined us for today's episode of Man Alive. I hope it gives you a sense of what's possible and how good your life can be. If you like what you heard, I'd be so grateful for you to subscribe to Man Alive and write a quick review that helps men like you find us. And again, head over to shanajamescoaching.com/manalive to get outtakes, videos, and raw footage I only share there. These are some of the most interesting parts of these expert conversations. You can also grab your copy of The Unknown Power to accelerate your career and solidify your confidence with women, because the two are related, and I know you don't have to settle for one or the other. Join us each week for a new episode of Man Alive.